Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, this is our talkback program. No guests, no special investigative report, but lots of quality information on, well, health and healing. I'm going to talk about bacteria in your gums and why that's not a good idea. For those of you who like salsa, well, there's cilantro, something special that it does. Also, we have a way of boosting our learning and our memory, especially in children. I'll give you the latest on that. And for those of you who have pancreatic cancer, good news, bitter gourd can help you. I'll explain that. Eating berries can slash heart attack risk substantially. So we have a lot to share. Then from our environmental segment today, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What is it? Why is it bad? Why should you be concerned? Continuing with the series on corporatizing our lives from Dr. Brian Minch, I'm going to look today at oil. Also from Pat LaMarchie from Common Dreams, Mr. President, buy a history book. And also from The Guardian, you won't see this anywhere in the United States in any of the major media. The National Security Agency has been sharing the raw intelligence, including America's data, with Israel. And they're sharing all kinds of secret deals that places no limits on the use of that data by the Israeli. How is this not being front page news? Let's begin. We have a lot to share. And of course, we'll be taking your calls throughout the hour. Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. University of Louisville School of Dentistry says bacteria is responsible for gum disease, and that facilitates rheumatoid arthritis. Now, we know that certain viruses, like cytomegalovirus, found in the mouth, can also impact your heart and actually cause heart disease. This is new. This was published in PLOS Pathogens, and here's what it says. Does gum disease, quote, indicate future joint problems? The answer is yes, because researchers and clinicians have known for a long time that there's an association between prevalent chronic inflammatory diseases, periodontal diseases, and rheumatoid arthritis. And there is a microbiological mechanism. Now, they're not sure exactly how that happens, but they know that they found a particular type of unique enzyme, which then enhances collagen-induced arthritis if you have this bacteria in your mouth. So, quote, taken together, our results suggest that bacteria may constitute a mechanistic link between the gingivitis, periodontal infections, and rheumatoid arthritis. But this groundbreaking conclusion will need to be verified with further research, unquote. Now, what does this mean in lay language, and how can we benefit from this knowledge? First and foremost, we're not good at knowing the quality of our own oral health. You really need a holistic dentist twice a year to give you a thorough examination of your gums, check to see if your gums are receding, if they're spongy, if you're bleeding, even microscopic amounts of blood. Then, are your teeth strong or weak? Are you losing your enamel? Are they demineralizing or not? The same is true with your jaw. Then, do you have a clean tongue, a pink tongue, a smooth tongue? Is it all ridged with white? That means you have yeast overgrowth. And that means you probably have a bacterial overgrowth, and you could end up having a weakened immune system. Do you have sweet breath or bad breath? Now, some people, they never know the quality of their breath because people are generally too light to mention, unless it's a family member, someone close to us, that our breath isn't pleasant. And that comes from many different sources. You might have infections in your sinuses. and not know it. And that's especially true if you have food or beverage allergies. I have found repeatedly that when people give up milk and wheat and corn and sugar, that they are able to heal their sinuses, and therefore there's no longer dripping. What happens is the sinuses drain in the back of the throat. So as this mucus drips down into the throat, and that's why people clear their throat a lot, and you breathe and you exhale, the air goes across the bacteria. The bacteria is what smells, and the air just propels it out as you exhale. Then a lot of people have very spongy tongues, and therefore whatever they've eaten, the oils will get into the spongy tongues, and then every time they breathe, they're breathing across that, and that gives off also a bad odor, unpleasant odor. And then they may have a inflamed stomach, or they may have an ulcer in the stomach, and that regurgitation back up can cause bad breath. But all these things have something in common. They can all be prevented. They can all be reversed. But you've got to know about it. And this is saying if you do have a problem in the mouth, you can end up with arthritis in the joints. So, to prevent arthritis, make sure that you're flossing after every meal, brushing properly after every meal, using a quality mouthwash and a non-fluoride toothpaste, and then clean your tongue. Always the last thing you do after you rinse for about 60 seconds with mouthwash. Take a tongue cleaner and you gently, from the back to the front, twice, rinse it off, then rinse your mouth out. That will do more to give you a clean, healthy, fresh breath than anything else. And of course, staying healthy does. For those of you who like salsa, there's an ingredient in it called cilantro. This is from Science Daily. Quote, hence that a Mexican favorite ingredient and also used in Southeast Asia with other spices can be an inexpensive way for people purifying drinking water on the menu today at the National Meeting of American Chemical Society. Reporting on research done by undergraduate students at a community college, they found that cilantro, also known as coriander, or Thai parsley, shows promise as a much-needed bioabsorbent for removing lead and other potentially toxic heavy metals from contaminated water. Quote, cilantro may seem too pricey for use in decontaminating large amounts of water for drinking and cooking. However, cilantro grows wild in vast amounts in countries that have problems with heavy metal water pollution. It's readily available, inexpensive, and shows promise in removing certain metals such as lead, copper, and mercury that can be harmful to human health. Well, here in the United States, we generally use some form of activated carbon, and you can use that in your home system, or more advanced technology like ion exchange resins, which are very effective. However, they can be too expensive for use in developing countries. Now, when I've traveled around the world, I've frequently, especially in countries that have high levels of food poisoning, you'll see them putting cilantro and like lemongrass in water. And they're not doing it to flavor it. They're doing it because they will tell you it takes pollution out. So now that's been verified by this study. Very, very good there. Everybody wants to see that their children get a good start, especially with memory. The University of Illinois at Urbana has come up with new research published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS ONE that shows that children that engage in aerobic fitness boost their learning and memory substantially by over 30%. Now, we also know that unlike previous generations, today's children don't exercise much. They're in front of a computer, they're in a car, and we need to get them out exercising. Biking is great. Jogging is also good. And swimming is good. Playing tennis is good, but they're not doing it. We got to get them to do it and be an example. Do it with them. For those of you who know anyone with pancreatic cancer, there's some new research about the bitter gourd. It's also known as Carella or bitter melon. Now, I was using this with people I was working with full-blown AIDS in the 1980s with substantial success. In fact, the first time I used bitter melon, it was because a person from the Philippines, where it grows all over the place, told me that he used it. It was a physician. And I'd ask him about it. There was nothing really in the literature at that point. So I had some people, now this goes back before the official definition in 1984 of AIDS, but for about 10 years before that, there was a subset, small group of a fast-track AIDS activists, or participants, I should say, who were coming down with some very severe bowel disorders. And I got a call from a physician named Dr. Stephen Chiesa. And he said, Gary, he said, I can't handle this, and antibiotics are not working. Maybe you can come up with something that's more natural that could help them. So after counseling them and finding out what they needed, I started recommending bitter melon and then the juice of bitter melon. Now, it's bitter melon for a reason. It's bitter. But the results, I saw the first results in lowering the candida level in the body, the thrush level, which, when it overgrows, can actually grow into the lungs of a person and kill them. That was remarkable. So then I had some women who were suffering from vaginal yeast candida, so I suggested they start using it, and they benefited tremendously. So then anyone who had viral, bacterial, or fungal infections, I was recommending it. Now there are numerous studies on it. This is the latest. This is published in the peer-reviewed journal Carcinogenesis. And it says that bitter gourd juice restricts the ability of pancreatic cancer cells to metabolize glucose, and in the process cuts off the cancer's energy source. That, in effect, kills them. This was done by Dr. Argbal at the Cancer Prevention and Control at the Colorado University Cancer Center. And this is important. Quote, his findings, alteration in metabolic events in pancreatic cancer cells and the activation of MPA, activated protein kinase, an enzyme that indicates low energy levels in the cells. In just lay language, the more this juice that the person with pancreatic cancer has, the less energy to thrive and grow and live for the pancreatic cancer cells. It starves them to death. Then they die. Now we know from all the scientific literature that many diabetics eventually also suffer from pancreatic cancer. And bitter gourd has been shown to effectively control type 2 diabetes with some very good success. Now the bitter gourd or bitter melon has also been used as a folk remedy for thousands of years in India and Asia. And so now we know. So in fact, in one study, mice that were fed bitter melon were 60% less likely to develop pancreatic cancer. So that's all good. And people should start using it if they have conditions that would benefit, including diabetics. A new study, a good study, on eating berries. This is from the peer-reviewed journal Circulation, the Journal of the American Heart Association. Here's what it says. I'll quote this. And this was a major study. It says, quote, heart disease is the leading cause of death for women in the United States. And a healthy diet and increasing exercise and low stress helps keep our hearts healthy. But there are specific foods that can be eaten to prevent heart attack. According to the Harvard School of Public Health, strawberries and blueberries are able to slash the risk of a heart attack in women by a significant amount. And if you eat 3 or more servings of these healthy berries each week, you're able to reduce your risk of suffering a heart attack by over 30%. Now, the research looked at 100,000 women and tracked their diets for 18 years. and they found a 32% reduction just in the amount of berries per month. So we know that the berries work because the berries have all forms of phytonutrients that are very beneficial. So eat organic berries. I suggest eating the berries every day. And of course, some of you who are having your compounding red fruit powders, you're getting strawberries and blueberries. So you're way ahead of that curve. And flaxseed can help prevent breast cancer. And this is according to a series of studies that were published in the peer-reviewed Integrative Cancer Therapy. Here's what it says. It says that flaxseed and cancer, they looked at 1,892 records from a variety of biomedical databases, including Medline and the Cochrane group, and they found that the more flaxseed in flaxseed oil, you decrease hot flashes, you increase cell death, what is called apoptosis in tumors, you increase the HER2 expression of protein associated with breast cancer malignancy, you decrease that, you decrease breast cancer proliferation, you improve atypical cytomorphology, which is the normalizing of cells, you improve the anti-angiogenic activity, and you decrease the risk of breast cancer by 18%, improve mental health by 76%, and lowered your death rate among breast cancer patients by 32%. Quote from the study, current evidence suggests that flax may be associated with decreased risk of breast cancer. Flax demonstrates anti-proliferative effects in breast tissue of women at risk with breast cancer and may protect against primary breast cancer. Mortality, which is death, risks may also be reduced among those living with breast cancer. So that's good news. So something else, simple and easy, that empowers people that we can do. Inexpensive, I suggest having flaxseed oil, organic flaxseed oil, every day. Now to our environmental segment. As people know in this audience, I am opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It is a sellout. And we are overwhelmed with secrecy in the United States today, and we are now a fully functioning fascistic country. We're becoming a police state, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be the final ribbon on that gift to corporate and global interest. And here are some of the things that are the latest that we have found out about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. First, it will prevent effective regulation of Wall Street. Wall Street will have no regulation. Second, it will trade good-paying careers for sweatshop labor. Third, it'll destroy all family farms. Fourth, it'll accelerate global warming in the name of profits. It'll also keep people in the dark about everything. And it places corporate rights above our national sovereignty. Because this is an international treaty, and that trumps our Constitution. It'll crush our ability to support local economies. It'll weaken and undermine democracy at home and abroad. And President Obama has stated he's going to fast-track this. And he's got 600 major multinational corporations, their lobbyists, working with him on this. Most Congress members had no time to read the Patriot Act. Remember that? Well, they're not going to have any time to, if this is fast-tracked, to read this as well. So just remember, when the Trans-Pacific Partnership is signed into law, all of our rights, all of our opportunities to rebound back will be lost. Also, President Obama, according to Pat LaMarchi, you're really not up on your history. Quote, my fellow Americans, for nearly seven decades, the United States has been the anchor of global security. This has meant doing more than forging international agreements. It has been enforcing them. The burdens of leadership are often heavy, but the world is a better place because we have borne them, end quote. I'm sure many people in this audience saw or heard the president making that statement. So of the thousands of words the president said about a week ago in his television speech to the nation on Syria, 75 words that I just quoted are the most important. No man with such a fundamental misunderstanding of modern history should be deciding the fate of a new group of civilians, or any group. In this one paragraph, the president rolled the clock back to 1943, claiming in that particular lifetime of the United States, the actions on global security, our killings, have been more righteous and had better outcomes than the anticipated actions of others. And with this distorted view of the consequences, President Obama hopes once again to use bombs to set things right. Even if we shave 2 years off his timetable and move past the long-debated use of nuclear weapons, remember the bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which neither one was necessary, and we hence were the only country to use weapons of mass destruction at that level. Our paranoia alone over the spread of communism allowed us to rack up uncounted millions of civilian casualties. It was, many believe, the picture of a young girl running down the road on fire that helped bring about the end of the war in Vietnam. Or the other one, remember, with a captive with his hands tied behind his back, was just shot right in the head by that South Vietnamese, I think it was a colonel, and we just see him just being shot and dying. But that horrific scene of that little tiny precious girl running and on fire from napalm, which you can't put out, that girl was a victim of American chemical warfare. She was a flaming symbol, courtesy of what Obama called the anchor of global security. And one of our most recent examples of a world most definitely not a better place is on the ground in Iraq, as our depleted uranium that I've discussed many times on this program. That depleted uranium, the weapons decay, and we have so many stories now accumulating of atrocities committed by contracted soldiers as their young men and women take their own lives in record numbers following their repeated tours of duty. And we claim no moral superiority in the world, and certainly not in the Middle East. And as economic impact of our military blunders continues to wreak havoc at home, the effects of the sequester mean that the world is certainly not a better place in the classrooms, the homeless shelters, the soup kitchens, and everyday living rooms here in the United States. Additionally, between the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, there were dozens more misuses of American firepower. Cuba, Chile, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Laos, Cambodia, Indonesia, Libya, Angola, and Iran. This is just but a sample of our military intervention that did not make the world a better place. And because we've too often acted as the idea that we are the supreme, and therefore we're entitled. Did anyone forget the School of the Americas? And let us not forget the innocent lives lost in collateral damage drone strikes, caused because the global security anchor-in-chief's kill list was not as easily targeted as otherwise intended, or we were led to believe. It is heartbreaking to realize that a presidential career forged by the anti-war movement has antithetically rendered President Obama incapable of critical thought and the ability to adequately assess the legacy of our past globally enforced agreements, agreements with the likes of Augusto Pinochet and, yes, Saddam Hussein. In the United States, the blood of millions of innocents is on our collective hands. We don't necessarily have to beat our breast on a daily basis over the wrong we have done over time. But no president should ever claim our violent, unethical treatment of others was in their best interest and has made the world a better place. A leader who rewrites history cannot appropriately decide the future. And oh, by the way, in Saudi Arabia, they have allowed over 1,200 death row inmates to be let free, providing they go to Syria and fight Assad. And so they get money, their family gets money, if they go and kill people. So, this is jihad. And in total, inmates from Yemen, Palestine, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, Syria, Jordan, Somalia, Egypt, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and Kuwait chose to go and fight in Syria. All right, so now we have it. So to John McCain and to John Kerry, are these the moderates you're talking about? People taken off death row and to go kill people? I don't think so. And finally, I'm concerned, as is Dr. Brian Mensch, who I had on this program a few weeks ago, about how America has become corporatized at every level. You see it in the media. You see what stories they won't touch. You see it in the foundations that give grants to nonprofits. You see what they will not challenge. And one of the worst of the corporate interests out there is the nuclear industrial complex. You rarely hear it discussed. So any discussion about corporations that threaten the future of mankind must obviously include the nuclear industry. Even outside the realm of nuclear accidents, every phase of the nuclear fuel cycle releases radiation into the environment. The uranium mining, the milling, the fuel production, the power plant operations, and the multiple streams of waste. For example, out of sight, out of mind, and virtually out of the discussion of nuclear power are the 200 million tons of uranium mill trailings that still are scattered throughout the western United States, exposed to the winds and rain. Dr. William Locksett of Penn State University calculated that that operation of a single uranium mine could result in 8 million deaths over time. And Dr. Robert Pohl of Cornell University believes that the potential health effects from mill tailings could, quote, completely dwarf those in the rest of the nuclear fuel cycle and add significantly to the worldwide toll of death and mutations. In 1977, Dr. Walter Jordan of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission stated the commission, quote, had underestimated radon emissions from tailings piles by a factor of 100,000. It's very difficult to argue that deaths to future generations are unimportant, he said. Well, radon gas is heavier than air, but can travel thousands of miles from its source, damaging chromosomes and causing cancer every mile of the way. And the health risks of radiation always have been viewed differently by scientists with a background in the hard sciences, physics and engineering, compared with scientists with a background in soft sciences, biology, genetics, physiology, and medicine. And generally, the hard scientists tend to discount risks of low-dose radiation and are more often proponents of nuclear power. And the soft scientists observe that biological organisms are too complex to establish rules for safe exposure. They more often oppose nuclear power, like the aforementioned scientists who have warned about mill tailings. Now, Hermann Mueller won the Nobel Prize for discovering genetic mutations caused by X-rays back in 1943. And in a paper he published in 1964 entitled Radiation and Heredity, he predicted the gradual reduction of the survival of the human species as the exposure to ionizing radiation increased. Now, since then, radiation to the human population has steadily increased. And in fact, sperm counts and fertility rates are dropping worldwide. According to a report from the European Science Foundation, multiple culprits are likely involved, but our exposure to radiation, from medical procedures to fallout from nuclear tests and accidents in power plants, is at the top of the list. And the National Academy of Sciences' last report on the health risks of radiation was back in 2006. And they stated that all radiation has consequences, and no dose can be considered safe. And radiation damage is cumulative. Each successive dose builds upon the cellular mutations caused by the last. It can take years for radiation damage to manifest pathology. And for nuclear apologists to declare that no one died from Fukushima, so onward with the nuclear renaissance, reveals childlike ignorance and deliberate deception. In fact, Dr. Janet Sherman, in a peer-reviewed published article in the Science publication, found that over 12,000 Americans, mainly babies, on the West Coast died because of the fallout from Fukushima. And the big Fukushima cloud is on its way. It'll be here in the next couple of months on the West Coast. And then we'll see a spike also. I'll keep you up to date on that. Back next week, I intend to interview a leading environmental scientist, showing you the truth of how bad it is in Japan. So all, and by the way, today they announced that all nuclear power plants now, every single one in Japan has been shut down. And the country is doing fine without it, but also that's because of a strong movement on the ground. So all nuclear power plants are potential global disasters that threaten the future of humankind and every living thing. Every human has been affected by radiation from the 1986 Chernobyl accident because the radiation eventually circumnavigated the entire globe. And radiation's calling card is damage to chromosomes that can be passed on to subsequent generation. And chromosomal damage is not just the first step in a long road to cancer and infertility. It's also a common denominator for myriad diseases and dysfunctions involving virtually every organ system. Fukushima, although it has disappeared from the news cycle for about 2 years, only popping up recently when it was shown that it's getting worse, not better, that they lied to the people. It's the biggest industrial catastrophe in the history of the world. Three self-sustaining nuclear meltdowns that will not be fully contained for years. Six damaged reactors, the equivalent of 20 nuclear cores exposed. Half of Japan is now contaminated. I believe within the next 5 years, the entire island of Japan will be so contaminated that its entire population will have to be relocated. And I believe, though I have no proof of it, but I believe that they are probably working closely with China for much of the Japan population to inhabit those phantom cities that hold about 60 million people throughout China. So let's be realistic. Half of Japan is contaminated. The cleanup will cost at least $10 trillion. The Japanese government has admitted that the amount of radioactive cesium-137 released by the Fukushima nuclear disaster was far greater and is the equivalent of 168 Hiroshima bombs. And that doesn't count the radioactivity that is still being spread into the Pacific Ocean from the radioactive contaminated water used to cool the doomed reactors, which will end up distributed throughout the global ecosystem. So the whole concept of nuclear power plants, launched by President Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace speech to the UN in 1953, was an afterthought to the development of nuclear weapons. The public had become terrified of the mutually assured destruction that we were told about, and thus politicians, convinced that nuclear arms were nonetheless imperative, were looking for more, let's say, a way of soothing America's nuclear anxiety. And so the promise of safe, too cheap to meter electricity turned out to be a complete and utter fraud. The public was lied to by the government of the United States, France, the United Kingdom, and Russia. All played a role in that deception. But so did the corporations that stood to cash in on the nuclear power boom. The companies that helped bring us those nuclear power plant disasters, General Electric, Hitachi, Toshiba, through flawed designs, poor construction, cheap materials, and privatizing their whole efforts to keep everything secret. Their priority was profits over safety. And they've had virtual immunity from financial consequences. In virtually every country with nuclear reactors, the law seriously limited a nuclear company's liability to a tiny fraction of the real damages. So, when that is the case and a corporation's only motive is profit, there's little incentive for them to prioritize safety. And the list of examples of nuclear corporations cutting safety corners to save money is too long for me to mention right now. But how the nuclear industry responded after the Fukushima debacle is just the most recent example. Rather than being chastened by that disaster, the nuclear industry has done just the exact opposite. They acted like nothing happened. And hence, don't worry about it. Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission spent a year assembling at least 12 post-Fukushima safety improvements, but succumbing to industry pressure, chose to demand only 3. Then it gave the industry up to 5 years to comply. And recently, the nuclear industry complained to congressional Republicans that the NRC chairman, Gregory Jasko, was being too aggressive in pursuing post-Fukushima safety regulation, so they fired him. Now, granting a license extension to an existing nuclear power plant may not seem like much of a reason to march and protest, but nuclear reactors have a limited lifespan because all their components are old and the materials degrade more quickly because of the radioactive exposure. So extending a plant's life of operation indefinitely increases the risk of an accident. So far in this year, 71 nuclear reactors have applied for a 20-year extension of their licenses, and all 71 have been approved, many with the same design flaws as found in Fukushima. So finally, this brings us to the fossil fuel industry. And as I'm sharing this with you now in our studios in New York, the temperature in some places is really phenomenal. And we've had one of the worst summers and starting in the early fall ever, some of the worst flooding. Just look at what is happening out in Colorado right now. People dead, whole communities isolated. Rather ironic because just 2 months ago, I was in Colorado in Denver on PBS, and I was showing Seeds of Death, but afterwards I offered as a premium, a survival kit, you know, water filter and what to do when disaster strikes through our CDs. And I had someone in the studio who was a volunteer come up to me and says, you know, you'll probably not get much of an interest because out here in Colorado, you don't see all those disasters. Well, right after that, within a week, worst fires in Colorado history, now the worst flooding in Colorado history, all within 60 days. Well, that's one of the times you don't want to be right. Now look at how hot it is. It hit 105 degrees in Salt Lake City. No relief was coming. Western forces are on fire all over the place, still going on in California. So our reservoirs are only half full. So this is serious. So to keep the climate stabilized enough to maintain civilization as we come to have known it, or even to avoid mass starvation and global chaos, we'll have to stay within a carbon budget. And the world must only allow about 1/5 of the known economically recoverable reserves to be extracted and burned. But no corporations out there involved are entertaining any thoughts of self-restraint. As mindless, amoral, and unbridled as the malignancies destroying, you know, people, ExxonMobil, TransCanada, Peabody Energy, Koch Industries, and the like, employ hundreds of thousands of people working like tumor cells for the relentless destruction of the environment, where the consequences are the destruction of the environment. They could care less. And the rest of us just stand by and watch. In fact, if we work for a bank, we may only be watching it happen. We may be loaning the money to make sure it happens. So if the fossil fuel industry seems just so disjointed from reality, understand that this is just the beginning. According to the Environmental Investigative Agency, many Chinese and Indian companies that make the refrigerant HCFC-22 are demanding big money to dispose of a byproduct of that process. The HFC-23, which is a greenhouse gas, 14,000 times more potent than CO2. Despite having cheap destruction technology readily available, they intend to hold their stores of HFC-23 hostage until the rest of the world pays up. This has caught the attention of other manufacturers of HCFC-22 in developing countries who are poised to join the climate bomb threat. And under a UN program, incinerators for HFC-23 are installed at 19 refrigerant facilities, mostly in China and India, but also in South Korea and Argentina and Mexico, to help control the super greenhouse gas. But we're not even talking about it in the United States. If you doubt me, ask someone, what is HCFC-22 or what is HFC-23? They're clueless. So all disturbing as all this is, something looms on the horizon that could dismantle what fuel tool citizens have to defend their health and environment and climate from evisceration by corporate invaders from across the globe. And I'll get to that on my next discussion. But just remember, I've mentioned many times the Trans-Pacific Partnership is coming, and it is the single worst treaty in American history. And if this gets through, all the special industries will have their way, and we will be left with all the consequences and no opportunity to challenge it. And in a police state, when you go to challenge it, you're now considered an enemy of the state. I'm Gary Knoll. Now it's time for your calls. Let's go to the phones. Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Let's say hello to Gail from New Orleans. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good.
Great. I was calling to find out if you know anything about laminine, a supplement called laminine. I'm a vegetarian and I'm trying to go vegan, and I know that it has shark cartilage as well as organic fed hen embryos.
You know, why are you interested in it?
Actually, I was speaking with someone at a health food store, and they were trying to say that it would help me reduce fibroids. I've been having complications from fibroids for quite some time.
The original work on that involving the shark cartilage was not accurate. It was not sustainable. It was heavily promoted, but it didn't have any real substantive science behind that, so I would say no. There's many other things you can do for fibroids.
And to reduce the size as well as the impact on, because it's like pressing on the organs.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yeah, have you ever done comprehensive detoxification?
I've tried a few things like the Master Cleanse. But
those are minor. We're talking about, you have to get yourself into the hands of someone who can really work with you. Do you have anyone down there in New Orleans? Hello? She's still on?
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Do you have anyone down there?
No, okay. Actually, I don't.
Well, then let me give you a couple suggestions that might get you started, all right?
And also, I'll be going to the D.C. area shortly. So if you knew someone in that area as well, that would be helpful.
There I do. And by the way, when you get to New Orleans, you can hear every day, Monday to Friday, 3 p.m., mm-hmm. on WPFW, our sister station.
Oh, okay, great.
Right.
That would be great. Okay, I have a pen. I'm ready.
Okay, well, first let me just give a little background for some of the other people in the audience, because I like the answers to always be able to educate people, not just the person who's asking it.
Yes. My
guest on the line right now, Gail, is talking about uterine fibroids. Now, these are the benign growths that form in the interior muscular walls as well as the exterior of the uterus. And it not only involves the uterus, but also the cervix as well. And the term fibroid, somewhat misleading, because the tumor cells are not fibrous. They're abnormal muscle cells. And their position within the uterus determines what they're called, submucosal, intramural or one of the others. So in a lot of women, probably up to 30% of all women develop fibroid tumors. So what do we do? First and foremost, I have found from my experience that when you have a lifestyle modification, you have to have the discipline to give up all caffeine. I think caffeine is probably in the top three things that contribute to fibrocystic breast and uterine fibroids. So give up the coffee completely. Then go on a alkalizing diet. Lots of raw fruits, vegetables, nuts, walnuts, pine nuts, cashews, pistachios. Use lots of flaxseed oil, but also every morning and every evening, make sure that one serving of the black cumin seed oil, C-U-M-I-N, cumin, but also twice a day serving of the omega-3 fatty acids, generally around 1,500 milligrams. Then three times a day, ubiquinone, which is coenzyme Q10, generally 300 milligrams. It creates tissue oxygenation. And I would also use a garlic probably five times a day, L-arginine, which helps retard all the excess growth, the maitake, M-I-A-I-T-A-K-E extract, shiitake mushrooms, vitamin A is very important. Vitamin C throughout the day, probably every 2 hours. Dandelion root, milk thistle, Chinese skullcap. Curcumin, generally five times a day. Curcumin. And then non-caffeinated green tea three or four times a day. And so those are the things that I would definitely suggest. All right? So make sure that, and also make sure that you're using green juices. The more chlorophyll you get into the tissue, the better it is for you. And I would start with something simple. Wheatgrass juice diluted in apple juice. Green apple juice with lemon and two tablespoons of wheatgrass juice. Now, you do that and you let me know in about a month if you've noticed a difference, all right?
Okay, great. Can I get one correction from you?
Yeah.
Curcumin was five times a day?
Yes.
And shiitake, I'm sorry, maitake.
Maitake extract.
And five times a day?
No, once a day. And shiitake is to eat the actual mushrooms.
Oh, eat the mushrooms. Okay, great. And how much L-arginine?
L-arginine as directed.
Okay, as directed. And how about ubiquinone?
300 milligrams three times a day.
300 milligrams.
All right.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much, Gary, and I will give you a report.
Thank you, Gail from New Orleans. And we have Eve from Los Angeles. We have Arthur from Connecticut. We have people all over America. I'm looking at my board here. It's just packed. First we'll go to Arthur from Connecticut. Hi, Arthur.
Hi, Gary. Gary, my question is about Lyme's disease.
Yeah.
We took a tick off my daughter about a month ago, and the tick tested positive for Lyme's, but she has no symptoms and she was not tested. So I was wondering, what is your view of the tests and the current treatment, and what might you recommend?
I'm opposed to the current treatment because of all the antibiotics, which can knock out the immune system. It really destroys all good bacteria in your body, especially in the gut. And then a person ends up having secondary effects from not having a balance between the good bacteria and the bad bacteria.
Sure.
So first understand that Lyme's disease does not always manifest for a period of time.
Right.
But then have the titers taken again at about 3 months. If she hasn't shown any titers within 3 months or symptoms, then she may not have been, she may not have been infected.
We haven't done any tests yet. Do one now, do one in 3 months?
Yeah, one now and one in 3 months.
And what do you think of the, what else would you recommend? Let's say it's positive.
Well, I have a whole protocol for Lyme's disease. But first, get back with me with the results.
Okay.
All right?
Will do. Thank you very much.
Okay, Arthur. For the last part of our program, I want to spend a little more time on the environment, because something concerns many of you, and rightly so, and that is, it's not just the tar sands development, but it's also a growing concern about water usage. Now, according to Yale 360, Ed Struzik, there is a big concern because environmental questions about Canada's massive tar sands development have long centered on greenhouse gas emissions. Now they're mounting concerns about the huge amount of water used by the oil industry and the impact on the vast Mackenzie River Basin. Let me share what he wrote on this. He says, opposition to the mining of Alberta's tar sands, the Keystone and Gateway pipelines that would carry their oil to the Mexican Gulf and the Pacific Ocean, has largely been focused on the project's greenhouse gas emissions and threats to pristine environments along the pipeline rights of way. But another serious issue is coming to the fore, the massive amounts of fresh water being used by the industry. In 2011, Company Mining, the tar sand siphoned off 370 million cubic meters of water from the river alone, which was heated or converted into steam to separate out the vicus oil from the sand formations. Now let's just put that in perspective. That quantity exceeds the amount of water to the city of Toronto, with a population of nearly 3,000 people, used annually. But unlike the water used by people in Toronto, tar sands companies pay nothing for the water. All they need is a license from the province of Alberta, nor do they clean it up after recycling it and pumping it back into the underground aquifers or into tailings ponds, which now cover over 170 square kilometers. That's about 66 square miles in northern Alberta. Now, a growing number of scientists and economists believe the tar sands and the industry has already reached a tipping point in its dependence on both surface and groundwater. They contend that the timing and magnitude of these diversions are drying up wetlands, disrupting water flows, and potentially threatening the habitats thousands of miles downstream along the Mackenzie River Basin, which drains 20% of Canada. Quote, nowhere in the world are we seeing this amount of groundwater being used for industrial development. That is William Donahue, a freshwater scientist and lawyer. And he said the scale of these withdrawals of water is massive and totally unsustainable. Henry Vo, a natural resource economist at the University of California and lead author of a recent report on the Mackenzie River Basin by the Rosenberg International Forum on Water Policy, says it's time that the tar sands industry exploitation of water be addressed. Quote, it's an alarming scenario, says Vo, whose report links heavy water use by the tar sands to potentially harmful changes in the Mackenzie River Basin, including water pollution, wetlands destruction, and changes in drainage patterns in the Mackenzie headwaters. Quote, given the rate of expansion in the industry, it's going to get a lot worse. Now let me put this in lay language. To produce a barrel of oil from the tar sands, the industry says it typically needs about 3.1 barrels of fresh water. In 2008, the tar sands produced 1.3 million barrels of oil per day. That is expected to double to 3 million barrels in the next 4 years, further straining water supplies on the river and the aquifers in northern Alberta. In addition to withdrawing water from other sources, tar sands operations are authorized to divert 652 million cubic meters of water from the river, double the current volume of withdrawals. Now, until several years ago, most tar sands was obtained through open pit mining, which requires the draining of wetlands, the diversion of streams, and clear cutting of forest, and the removal of soil overburden. At last count, more than 400 square miles of land were being mined in this way. And the sands are then transported to an extraction plant where hot water is used to separate oil. In recent years, however, in situ mining of tar sands, which involves injecting steam into tar sands deposits too deep to be surface mined, has escalated. The oil is recovered through an assisted gravity draining process in which steam and solvents are pumped into the upper portion of the tar sands reservoir. There, the bitumen warms and thins and then drains down into the lower part of the reservoir before being pumped back to the surface. Now, these open pit tar sands operations return almost none of the water they use back in the natural cycle because it's simply too toxic and therefore subject to a zero discharge policy. Although a large percentage of the wastewater is recycled, most of it eventually ends up in tailing ponds, and wastewater from in-situ processes is routinely reinjected into the deeper aquifers. And this is all bad because we're not paying attention to any of this. Stephen Wallace, head of the Province of Alberta's Groundwater Management Unit, says that the industry's withdrawal of water from the river amounts to about 1% of the river flow, although that figure is expected to grow to about 2.5% as production increases. He acknowledged that this percentage is often much higher in periods of low flow, but it's still water that's coming out and it's not going back. So let's put all this in perspective, and why is this important? Here's what's important. We have been told that we need to become more energy independent. I would agree with that. Unfortunately, this administration has considered nuclear, clean coal, an oxymoron that just boggles the mind, and of course, tar sands, and some of the other very polluting industries as part of this enormous subsidy into the tens of billions of dollars. We're not putting money where it should go. We're not putting money into wave power, which is free. Why? Because the waves never stop. Now, if you've ever been to the East River in New York City, they have one of these turbines there, and it just keeps going 24/7. It doesn't hurt the fish. They have screens. It doesn't impact the environment, not like windmills that are 400 foot high and cause a noise that can cause neurological problems and can kill millions of birds worldwide. And these things have a lot of problems. It's a big plus. If you want to put a windmill out, fine, put it out in the ocean. Put it on top of the Continental Divide up in the Rockies, out of sight. And there, take advantage of those incredible winds. But what about something that Iceland's been using for a long time and has mastered the technology better than any other country in the world? Geothermal. We have thousands and thousands of geothermal springs in the United States. That's another way that we could tap into something that's natural, non-polluting. But we're not. So two of the most viable and non-polluting and permanent forms of energy we're not paying anything to. So instead, we make deals with a Canadian company that is destroying their forest, destroying their water, really absolutely eviscerating the land around it. And now they're taking all this excess water. Well, sooner or later, that's going to come back on everyone. And then we're transporting this down to the Gulf of Mexico. But hold on, weren't we told this would help America? None of that oil that's going to be transported in the Keystone Pipeline wind up in the United States. It's all meant to be exported out of the Gulf to other countries. So it was all just a game. It was a manipulation. So before the president says yes or no on this in its final form, let us be aware that there's a lot more at stake here than just having an accident and a pipeline rupturing and polluting something in the United States, whether it's land or water. We're talking about the destruction of water in Canada, and we have to be conscious of that as well. We're out of time. I look forward to sharing more on our next program, and I thank you all for taking your time to be with us here.